Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the AfriCast. My name is Brendan Lotz, and joining me today is Clinton Matos.
That's me. Hello, everybody.
And Robin Lichetti.
Hey, how's it going?
How are you guys doing on this blisteringly cold Friday afternoon?
Still alive. Fine. Everybody's so down. It's so down.
About the same, yeah.
Yeah, it's not a fun situation at the moment. But anyway, we soldier on. Robin, let's jump straight into it. You have some news. It's not very good news, but it's news.
Yeah, I guess we start off on a somber note. It's regarding Amazon and kind of how they've been responding to during the COVID-19 pandemic, and in particular how poorly they've been doing. Their workers in their warehouses have been on the front lines trying to deliver services in specifically. And unfortunately, there's been another COVID-19 related death with one of the employees. This is the seventh death from COVID-19 that Amazon has disclosed. And for some odd reason, the company stubbornly refuses to actually disclose how many of its employees have tested positive for COVID-19. So a lot of what they're doing at the moment, or not doing at the moment, is coming to the spotlight. And I think it kind of serves as a good example for local retailers and other e-commerce platforms on what not to do. This is not how you handle a global pandemic. I thought one of the quite concerning when 60 Minutes did a report on Amazon and kind of how it's been dealing with things regarding COVID-19. And there was one of the senior VP for worldwide operations, Dave Clark, was asked specifically why the company hasn't disclosed COVID-19 infection numbers. And his response was that those figures are not a particularly useful number. And I thought that was really narrow-minded kind of view to take on things. I understand it would not be useful for Amazon, purely for the fact that if the number was high, the chances are people will be far more reluctant to use their services. So it seems like this is more a ploy to ensure that customers continue using the services and kind of, for lack of a better term, screwing over the employees that are now essentially risking their lives in order to deliver a service to customers. So yeah, it's not great on Amazon's part in any way.
I think I've heard that excuse like three times from various sources, all of them from America. One of the states said that they wouldn't be revealing their numbers because they don't want people to panic. It's like...
Yeah, people are panicking regardless. Just be completely transparent in what you're doing. It boggles the mind, really.
And, yeah. You're going to get more retailer stuff later, unfortunately. Or fortunately, depending on how you look at things.
Right, so moving on, I want to chat a little bit about malware, or specifically the state of of ransomware 2020 report from Sophos. So Sophos published a report this week regarding how popular ransomware is in 2020. And interestingly, it's not as popular as it was 2 years ago when Sophos ran a similar survey. In fact, of the respondents in 2017, 54% said that they'd been hit by ransomware, and this year only 51% said that they'd been hit by ransomware, which is a nice decrease. But something I want to touch on specifically is South Africa and us being a target for ransomware. According to Sophos's data, so they surveyed 5,000 IT professionals from around the world, and 200 of those were from South Africa. So it's not a massive sample size, but it does give us a little bit of a snapshot of how things are playing out in the cybersecurity space. And interestingly, South African respondents, 24% said that they had been hit by a ransomware attack, which is incredibly, incredibly low. Just above us is Poland, where 28% of respondents said that they had been hit. And above them is Philippines, which had 30% of respondents reporting that they had been hit by malware. And curiously, the reason that this number is so low, according to Sophos, is because attackers are choosing their targets a lot more carefully now, and countries with lower GDPs aren't as tempting of a target anymore because, well, we just don't have the money to pay up So it's kind of pointless saying, hey, pay up or we'll encrypt all your software when the person, or your data when the person's like, well, I can't pay anyway, so have at it, mate. Really, really interesting to see that as the reasoning there. And part of this is Sophos saying that attackers are moving from a spray and pray methodology to something that's a lot more targeted, specifically in terms of server-based attacks, because they usually end up costing a lot more money. You can charge more for the ransom and that sort of stuff. But yeah, and then the other thing that I want to touch on is don't pay the ransom. In their research, Sophos found that you actually end up paying more if you pay the ransom than if you don't pay the ransom, because obviously you need to deal with data recovery and disaster recovery and all that sort of stuff. Plus, now you've paid a ransom. So don't pay the ransom. That should be obvious, but don't pay a ransom if your stuff gets encrypted. Obviously, take precautions so that that's less of a risk. But yeah, really interesting data. We'll have a link to that at the bottom of this. And within that story, you'll be able to find the full State of Ransomware 2020 report from Sophos. Clinton, what do you have for us this week?
Yeah, so I've got something. Got a weird name on top of a weird concept. It's called the Pumpix. I don't know why it's called that, but just bear with me. Basically, it's Spider-Man's web shooters, but instead of web goo, you've got hand sanitizer. So this is something you need to see in motion. Again, links to everything we discussed will be below the podcast. But there is a crowdfunding campaign for this product called the Pumpix, and it's a wrist-mounted. They give it a weird name. I think they call it a sanitizer spritzer that you put on your hand. It doesn't take cartridges or anything like that. You can fill it up with whatever hand sanitizer you have on you. And then you push a little button and it gives a nice little spritz of the sanitizer. You can use it on your hands, obviously, but then things like handles, lift buttons, things like that, anything people are touching all the time and don't get cleaned that often. And the people making it say that it's good for 100 spritzes, even though the reservoir is only, I think, 12 milliliters. So it's not that big. And I just thought this was bizarre, and I can't tell if it's kind of clever or kind of dumb. At the time of speaking to you now, they've raised $12,000. They only had a $5,000 goal, which is really low. And they've been raking in the money over the past few days that this has been out. And yeah, I just think it's really cool. And I think if they went to Disney, if they have the patent on this, if they went right to Disney and they'll be like, hey, can we get the Spider-Man themed and we'll sell it as like a kid's toy, but it's also for hygienic purposes. I think they could have made a killing, but they've just gone straight to Kickstarter. So they are going to be going for 16 more days. And then who knows? Will this become a retail project product you can buy anywhere? Is this going to be a once-off thing? Is somebody going to recreate it and put the files up on Thingiverse?
That's what I was about to say. I was about to say that's what's going to happen.
And it's kind of funny because they've got prototype pictures here that have clearly been 3D printed. And then in the little video they have, the thing is 3D printed as well. They actually show a 3D printer going. And I'm pretty sure someone with some know-how won't even need to watch the video. They can just do it themselves.
Yeah.
And again, I think it's cool, but it's also kind of silly. A lot of people have said the little button that they have on top, you need to put your finger on it to activate it, which isn't great because that's where all the dirt is. But then you could just use it with your wrists or I don't know. This is a completely dumb product. There's no electronics. There's no Bluetooth. There's no pairing it with an app.
Oh, dumb as in not smart. Okay.
Yes, that's what I mean. Yes. Yeah, I don't mean it's a silly idea. Again, I'm on the fence about that. It's not things on Kickstarter and Indiegogo always have an app. That's their thing, right? It's your smart water bottle. Here's your smart juice press. Here's your smart whatever. This is just something you wear on your wrist and it sprays hand sanitizer. So I think this is something to keep in the back of your minds just to watch out for. And I think in like 6 months, we'll probably see about 100 copycats. Anyway, that's the Pumpix. Go check it out. As always, we have to give the warning, don't spend any money on crowdfunding that you're not willing to lose entirely. It's basically like a gamble.
Right. So with the news out of the way, let's actually keep this trend of dumb products going. No, I'm kidding. This week, actually yesterday, on Thursday, the Minister Ibrahim Patel, who is the Minister of Trade, Industry and Competition, announced that e-commerce is allowed in full. Anything that a e-tailer can sell, they can sell, with the exception of cigarettes and tobacco products. Cigarettes, tobacco products, and alcohol. Which is a shocking about turn when, at the end of April, the same minister was quoted as saying, if we open up any one category, let's say e-commerce, unavoidably, there's enormous pressure to do the same for physical stores or spas or shops for informal traders, so there is fair competition. Basically saying that if we allow e-commerce to be available, it would not be fair to physical retail locations. And
so does that mean that next week you're going to hear about physical retailers being allowed to operate again?
Well, this is what the subject of today's podcast is going to be about. We're going to pick up the conversation that we started last week, which was around e-commerce and the comments that were made specifically about it being unfair and and kind of just try and wrap our heads around this. So I'm going to kick off with Robin. You wrote the story. Let's start off with an opinion thing. Were you shocked to see that you could now buy anything online all of a sudden?
Slightly shocked. I think there was growing pressure anyway, so it seemed like Minister Patel kind of acquiesced. But I wouldn't say like genuine shock, like how could they have done this? It was more a case of, okay, I saw this kind of coming. Why it was done so quickly after saying, making his remarks in April, I'm not too sure. I think it also kind of brought up the whole idea of then why were e-commerce platforms kind of banned in the first place, or why were they only allowed to do essential items in the first place? Because it kind of also brings up the question of, regardless of whether or not your e-tailers are allowed to sell whatever they want to, with the exceptions of cigarettes and alcohol, they still will, in their warehousing situations, will only have a limited amount of staff or employees working there.
Yeah.
So even though you're able to order a lot more items now, the actual delivery times are still going to be quite constrained and going to be quite long. So it doesn't really make sense in my mind. I understand that it opens up avenues for a lot of e-tailers that were struggling. But yeah, it brings into question a lot of the thinking that government has gone through. And as confusing as it's been for us, it seems like it's been equally confusing for grapple with these kind of elements.
Clinton, reactions. What was your reaction to the news?
There's that famous gif of Captain Picard saying mild shock and then making a shocked face. That's kind of how I feel. I didn't expect it to happen so quickly, literally overnight in the period of a few hours. But once I read Robin's story, he kind of answers why it happened. The CEO of Takealot, Kim Reid, spoke to Business Insider South Africa, and they specifically said, we've been doing a lot of lobbying. They used the word lobbying, which I thought was kind of a no-no in the business and politic world. But yeah, they basically say, we've been lobbying for this to happen, and now it's happened. Pat ourselves on the back. So I think big businesses like Takealot and the whole cabal behind them were putting pressure on government, and they must have known the right pain spots to put that pressure on, and now it's open. That's the whole thing. They knew what to do, and they did it, and I'm not too surprised. I'm just worried, obviously, because the whole reason that, you asked this, Brendan, why did they only allow certain things? Well, because people need certain things like food and medication. But they don't need to go buy, a new phone case right now, right? That's not important. You don't want someone working in the warehouses or on the phones or in the delivery chain. Why are you putting them in danger for a phone case or whatever? It was kind of accepted that we would do that for important items like food and medication. But now when you're talking about other things, people don't see, or the government other side is saying, we don't really see the merit. But now, I guess they do see the merit. So yeah, it's on the one hand, it's surprising, but on the other hand, it's not at all surprising. So that's my take. Robin kind of answered my questions about it in this story. And you, Brendan, because you actually suggested last week we talk about retailers, and now they've done a 180.
So I was the thing that shocked me was the fact that online retailers can now sell anything. That means you can go and order a new oven if you need one. You can get a replacement controller for your PlayStation if you need one. And while I kind of appreciate that, it does make me wonder why I can't go to a physical store to get these things. I know this is kind of flying in the face of what has now been done, and I'm grateful that we are allowed to have online retailers operating in their entirety now. But I think it's important to ask the question, how was this decision arrived at, even when we support the decision? And the reason I say this is I'm coming back to what we said last week, which is that government needs to be a bit more transparent in how it's making these decisions. I think you're seeing a lot of comments on social media today about people praising government and saying, thank you for making this decision and we appreciate it and this is the right way to go. But I think it's important to understand the thinking that got us to this point, right? Because the question is now going to be asked by the likes of your physical brick and mortar retailers why they are not allowed to sell a sandwich machine, or why they are not allowed to sell an oven or a two-plate stove or things like that. I think that question is now going to be asked by retailers, because as we mentioned last week, online deliveries or e-commerce is not something that is accessible to all South Africans. So by making this announcement, you're basically saying that, and I do want to stipulate that government did say that online retailers must make every effort to provide delivery to as many South Africans, payment options, enabling poor customers to access these delivery services. But that's one side of the coin. Number one, how are these folks supposed to shop online? Are they opening up their budget laptop that they bought on the 350 Rand grant that they were given by government to go and shop on an online store and then hope that they deliver in that area, pay a premium for the delivery, etc., etc., etc.? It does make me wonder what drove this decision, but retailers are still limited in what they can sell. And yeah, it's making it once again highlights an issue that Ramaphosa highlighted in his speech earlier this week, stating that government hasn't been clear on how certain decisions were made. They didn't make sense. They were contradictory. And now we're having something like this, where a day earlier, Ibrahim Patel told us that, well, you can only buy a t-shirt if it's advertised as underwear. What? Like, what's going on? I feel that there's this disconnect now, and it's becoming more and more apparent as we go on. So yeah, for me, it was a massive shock to see, okay, e-commerce is allowed, and it's a free-for-all at the moment, with the exception of alcohol and cigarettes. I really would like to see how these decisions are arrived at and what is taken into account. Good on Kim Reid and, like you say, the retail sector for lobbying for this and pushing it and putting forward their suggestions and stuff. But it's mind-boggling. And then to build off of that, sorry, I'm kind of stealing the show here, but none of these measures that are implemented are new. If you look at the regulations that were gazetted, these are all things that, number one, places like Take a Lot have been doing since they've been delivering essential goods, and like there's nothing new here. Like, employees need to be screened, they need to have their temperatures checked, goods need to be sanitized when they leave the warehouse, courier people need to wear masks and sanitize and all this sort of stuff. There's nothing new here. So was it just an opinion that was changed? And is that how we are determining these regulations, is based off of opinions rather than facts? I'm just struggling to see how this works. And I think, I think it's important that we ask the question, how did you get to this decision, even when it's a decision that we support?
Yeah, and I also want to know, are we going to learn the lessons that Amazon has ignored. You know, we started with Robin talking about the problems at Amazon and how they put their workers in danger. Is that just going to happen here as well, now that they're going to need all the staff hands on deck to fulfill normal orders?
And
Lord forbid there's a actual someone that's working in a warehouse dies because of COVID-19.
And
they're a member of Kosatu, for example. Kosatu will go crazy.
Well, I mean, beyond that as well, Takealot, we're using Takealot because they are the biggest one in the country. They are the brand that everybody knows. But Takealot doesn't have multiple warehouses where stuff is shipped. If somebody is discovered that they have COVID-19 in their warehouse, that warehouse is going to probably have to shut down. So that puts a massive blow into your supply chain. And like, I wonder if that's a consideration that's now being made as well. But it's kind of this thing of, how did you arrive at this decision? What facts were you given by the likes of Takealot and stuff? And to be clear, we're not saying that Takealot is the bad guy here. There are a lot of people that rely on deliveries, and it's really great that they pushed for this. And I support the fact that e-commerce is being kind of heralded as this way to have safe deliveries. People can get the stuff that they need without having to go into a high risk area. It is great. But like I say, we must ask the question, how did you come to this decision? The last thing we want is to have a situation like we do in with Amazon, where people are dying from a disease and they're just like, well, we don't need to tell you how many people have the disease in our warehouses. Yes, you do. Like, not just for staff, but for people shopping through there as well. Like, I'm not going to go and buy something off Amazon if I don't know that it's safe to buy that thing. Like, I mean, it boggles the mind how you can say something like, oh, it's not necessary for you to know that. Yes, it is. It's absolutely necessary if you're in the public eye and shipping things to people.
The really concerning part about that Amazon story was the fact that the death was only disclosed to employees at the warehouse. This was where their warehouse in Indianapolis, Indiana.
Mm.
The only reason why management actually mentioned the death that rumors were circulating around the warehouse that one of the employees wasn't coming in, and they actually pressed management for more information, and that's the only reason why it was disclosed.
Oh my gosh.
It's essentially a cover-up job.
That's scary. That is so scary.
I think in like 10 years, when hopefully we have a vaccine and everything and people have kind of forgotten about COVID, we're going to see a lot of these stories come out of the woodwork where they were suppressed, or people were under gag orders, or in the US government or other governments, it was classified. I think things are like going bad and we're just not being told about it because they don't want to lose face, basically. I really hope that doesn't happen, but in like 10 years' time, I can see it happening, which is very scary.
So after moaning for a little bit, I want to touch on something that was really good in the regulations. And we're looking here specifically at Section 5C of the regulations. We'll have a link to the gazetted regulations down at the bottom of this podcast if you are interested. And that section reads, in order to limit the social and economic hardship caused by the pandemic on local industries and enable consumer choice to support local producers, retailers must give prominence to those goods which are manufactured in the Republic of South Africa. So I think that is a really, really great thing. And it's already in effect on Takealot's website. You go to Takealot's main website, go to the homepage, you'll see there's a little section that says shop local, and you can shop all local products. So this is really great. But I do want to point out that this is not a free service. So Takealot has a section on its site where you can see what the breakdown is of the cost of advertising your product on their website and then them fulfilling the order, as well as storage of the product. So they'll basically act as the distributor for you and advertise it on their website, but there is a cost involved. It starts off with a monthly subscription fee of 300 Rand. Then there is a fee on sales through Takealot. There is a fee on fulfillment of the order. And then there is a fee on storage. Obviously, that a storage fee may or may not apply. You would have to just read through the terms of Take Lots contract in order to find out what those are. So it's nice that we have these sorts of things. But I wonder, do you guys know of any small businesses that have a website that is functioning, that sort of stuff?
So I got a few emails earlier today about it. So I don't know if these are small. So the official Nintendo store in Santon that opened again, and we're like, hey, we'll deliver. The Great Yellow Brick, which is the Lego store, that opened. But I haven't gotten anything in terms of smaller places opening up. And that was the point I wanted to make here. It's nice for these businesses to get back on the horse in terms of local stuff. But I don't know if you are an artisanal glassblower. I don't know, just like you do that, you've done it for 10 years, you sell your wares on the side of the road, whatever it is.
Yeah.
This is really benefiting you, right?
No.
You can't go to Take a Lot and be like, hey, I make 10 impressive glasswares per day. Can you sell them on the site? They'll probably tell you no, or they'll say yes, but it's going to be a ridiculous fee on your part. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm not somebody does that kind of thing, but it just seems like the businesses who already had themselves established now just have another boon during the lockdown.
Robin, have you seen anything from smaller retailers saying that they are open for deliveries?
Nothing from smaller ones. I think a lot of the feedback I'm getting is similar to Clinton in that to kind of survive and pivot to essential goods providers during lockdown. They're kind of open for business now, and like Clinton was alluding to, they essentially now have, I don't want to say monopoly because it's not a monopoly, but yeah, they've essentially now they've cornered off the market in such a way.
Oligopoly.
They can really stand to benefit. Yeah. So I also want to take a bit of a cynical view as to the whole promoting local products.
Yeah.
In my mind, I'm taking a cynical view here. To my mind, it kind of seems like government kind of threw that in purely to make it look as if they have some kind of control and they have some kind of power in this whole situation. The fact that the regulations that e-tailers have to adhere to in terms of handling and sanitizing products when they're deliveries, that kind of information just seems like it was thrown in there to say, hey, we've kind of spoken to e-tailers, this is the move we're going to make now, but they've got to adhere to all these new things that we've kind of thrown in there to kind of show it's just like a show of power. And it just strikes me as something that was thrown in there with, again, not a lot of thought, because fair enough, they can have a banner on their site that says buy local, but again, it's not incentivized. There's no, unless, of course, there might be some kind of discounts. I haven't really had a proper look at the Take a Lot site, so I don't want to comment on that. But I'm not seeing any way that having a banner on your website incentivizes people to start buying local. It just seems a tad odd. And again, placating a lot of South Africans. Again, these services are great for people that can afford them.
Mm.
But again, as we spoke about it last week, it comes to the people that really need access to services, that need to get things to them because they are stuck in their home and trying to adhere to the regulations for lockdown, really seeing a lot of solutions being provided for them.
Do you guys actually believe that anyone from government is checking up on these retailers to make sure they are sanitizing stuff? Physically, they are promoting local stuff on their websites. Do you think anyone is actually checking that?
I do believe that they are. In the first couple of weeks of lockdown, I did see ministers visiting businesses and making sure that they were adhering to lockdown. However, since level 4 was implemented and guidelines were published about directions in respect of hygienic workplace conditions, like, I think that since then, I'm not 100% sure, but it's difficult to say yes or no, because I may not follow those people on social media, or they're not as vocal about what they're doing online. But I don't know. I would caution that, yes, they are following up on these things, but obviously until we see that, we can't confirm or deny. Something else I do want to just mention while we're on the topic of local retailers with respect to online marketplaces. Something I have noticed is that if, for instance, we're going to use Takealot again, because as we've said, they are the bigger brand that folks know of. I have noticed that in terms of products that aren't stocked by Takealot that are supplied by a smaller business, those goods usually take longer to deliver, most likely because of the fees involved with storage at Takealot, which can climb very, very high very quickly. And the thing that I see is, especially as a shopper, is I see, okay, so I want to buy a iPhone USB charging cable because mine is broken. And there's one on the website that costs $50 and it's by a local retailer, but it's going to ship in 5 to 7 days. Whereas one that's stocked by Takealot that costs $80 can ship tomorrow. I'm going to go with the one that I can get now tomorrow because it's more expensive, but I get it faster. And it concerns me that government has, like you say, Robin, it feels like they just slapped that in there, play the hero, give prominence to local stuff, but where's the incentive? Where's the incentive for me, the shopper, to buy that stuff other than my good nature trying to support small businesses? And where's the incentive for retailers to market this stuff in a more prominent way and say, hey, look, buy local stuff, support these oaks, rather than, well, you know, we're going to just give it a free-for-all, and you make the decision. Obviously, you must have buyer choice. That's something that we should encourage. But also, at the same time, like you say, Robin, it's kind of just like, support small guys, please, if you can, by the by.
Yeah, it feels like the Wild West out there.
Something I do want to kind of then touch on a little bit more is with this now renewed hope and hunger for e-commerce in South Africa, I do wonder whether courier services are A, going to become more widespread, and B, improve. The reason I say improve is, even before lockdown, the part of the whole e-commerce value chain that I felt failed time and time again is delivery. The process of ordering is fine, the process of paying for your order is fine, the process of your order getting ready and packed is fine, but then everything falls apart when it leaves the warehouse and goes out for delivery. I cannot tell you how many times I've called a retailer to ask what's happening with my delivery, many days after it was due to be delivered, only for them to tell me, sorry, it's out of our hands, it's with the courier, and then I've got to talk to a courier, and it just becomes a mess. What do you guys think is, do you think that this is going to improve, or do you think that this is going to get worse?
I think it'll probably be the same. I've ordered and had things delivered and during lockdown.
Yeah.
And the experiences are much the same, just in terms of time delays and stuff like that. I'm perhaps a bit more interested to find out whether or not couriers are going to adhere to the regulations as far as face masks go, sanitization. Because the delivery that I did have during lockdown, it was definitely no adherence to those regulations.
So, same.
So I don't foresee that element ever changing. I think people aren't going, well, I think couriers and the people that are delivering aren't going to adhere to regulations as far as sanitization goes. Whether or not the service is going to improve, I think really for the fact there'll be fewer people in the warehouses, or at least there should be fewer people at the warehouses, will bring longer wait times. But those are things I'm willing to deal with, for the fact that I'm not ordering essential items.
Yeah.
I think if you're ordering essential things, it becomes critical. So again, for those kinds of queries, or those kind of situations, I'm not too sure if I fit the right model as far as those kind of services go.
So the only thing I've had delivered since lockdown has been food. I haven't actually ordered anything, I don't know what you call it, non-edible. I've just gone to the store when I needed groceries and other items like that. I think things will be kind of in shape at the beginning because all the people handling deliveries will say, hey, we've been given a chance to do work under lockdown here, make sure everything's good. But if we continue like this for a while, I think the cracks are going to start to show because it's a difficult job and now they need to do a difficult job with more difficult elements piled on top of them. It's difficult on top of difficult on top of difficult, right?
Yeah.
And eventually something goes wrong. So yeah, I think it'll be fine for a while, but if it continues how it is, things are going to get bad. And again, it's just all of this is new and the delivery company is a company like any other. They've never had to do this before.
Yeah.
So they're going to make mistakes because of that. And then they're going to make mistakes that would have happened regardless just because of how companies work.
Yeah, I don't want to court fate, but the first instance where a courier company, one of the delivery people, tests positive. Yeah, that's going to be very interesting to see what happens in because there's a big group that you need to start contacting. And
I mean, I didn't even think about that, Robin, to be honest with you. I didn't even think about the contact tracing that would need to be involved with that. Like, How many packages does a courier deliver in one day? How many people do they interact with? Did that person keep a 1.5 meter distance between them at all times? The questions then just start piling up and up and up. And adding on to that fact is theft and robberies. We've seen, especially in suburbs in Johannesburg, courier vehicles get robbed constantly on a daily basis almost. So is that something that is going to be accounted for? Are couriers going to have to be making multiple trips back and forth to a warehouse because they don't want to carry too much product with them at once just in case criminals see them? The questions just go on and on and on and on and on. And it like you say, the cracks do start to show over time. And I worry that government's lack of understanding of the situation regarding e-commerce has kind of led to some holes in this legislation. But once again, it circles back to the first point I made, is we need to ask how these decisions were arrived at and what factors played a part in reaching this decision. And unfortunately, because these directives came from Minister Patel, who people already don't have much faith in regarding the declarations that he makes. What with this U-turn on e-commerce, the really confusing classification of what winter clothing you can and can't buy, it kind of brings into question, as I said, how these decisions are made. Just beyond that, in terms of like couriers aren't really touched on much here. It's all about warehousing employees, and yeah, couriers must wear masks and that sort of stuff, but how must courier companies work with themselves? It's like, and a lot of times e-commerce companies don't have their own courier service. Takealot does, but on the same token, Takealot contracts out to a third party a lot of the time, especially for deliveries that are outside of major metropolitan areas. So is that a consideration that has been made? Like, it's just, as you start picking this apart, you start having 100 more questions and you kind of sit there wondering, well, what about this and that? And my brain is actually just sore right now thinking about it.
It just seems more reactionary than it is predictive.
Yeah.
In the way that decisions are being made. I know it's easy for us to sit back and kind of view the situations and then talk with hindsight in mind. But in my mind, this issue have been very easily solved by simply allowing e-commerce platforms to operate as they were previously, but then instilling certain regulations in warehouses and things like that.
Yeah.
Instead of saying outright, no e-commerce at all.
Yeah.
It just seems like now government is reneging on what they initially said. And now as new problems start cropping up, then they're going to start making different amendments to the regulations. So doesn't inspire much confidence. And it seems like a lot of these ministers are working against what President Ramaphosa has been saying and not really confirming what's going on with his with the presidency. It's so, really, really confusing.
So here's something else that I've just had this thought, right? So let's say, for instance, because Takealot's main base of operations is the Western Cape. Okay, their main warehouse is in Cape Town and their head office is in Cape Town. So let's say that Joburg or Gauteng goes on to level 3 at the end of May and Cape Town remains at level 4, right? So people would like to now purchase wine online for delivery. The wine comes from Takealot's offices in Cape Town. How do you execute that order? Because assuming, given the information that we have according to the risk-adjusted strategy on the SA Coronavirus website, at level 3, alcohol and tobacco will be allowed for sale. That could change, but as it stands at the time of recording this podcast, that would be possible. But let's say that we get to a stage where the Western Cape is still on level 4 and the country is on level 3, and I want to order a 6-pack of beer through Takealot because they advertise it and sell it there, and have it delivered to my house. How does that happen? Because essentially in the Western Cape, it's illegal to transport booze under level 4 regulations. But in Gauteng, it's completely legal. So how does that work? I understand that I might be jumping the gun here, but I think that this is a question, given that we want to be all at level 3 by the end of May, that's a question that needs to be answered in the next 2 weeks. I wonder if that's a consideration that's been made as well.
You better hope that the Midrand Takealot warehouse has some stock on hand.
I think they're going to have to, when you put in your delivery address, it will have to run through a little table that says, okay, what province is this? And then what level is this province? And is the item allowed during this level in this province? And then when you get to checkout, it will either say, okay, things are good to go, or be like, no, you can't do it.
I think the best course of action, rather, is to say the alcohol and cigarette deliveries can only happen after the lockdown period has ended.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
No, I agree with you 100%.
There are too many moving parts to say, one province is on this level, another province is on that level, and moving items becomes an issue.
It's crazy. Not that stuff, right? Because it's like you can't buy underwear under lockdown, apparently. But what if, I don't know, what if at level 2 you're allowed to buy underwear, but not at level 3? And then they have to go through the same rigmarole, but for underwear instead of alcohol and tobacco products.
Well, this is the thing, is it's like these are considerations that I feel should be made by the powers that be. Like, these are the debates that need to be had and the questions that need to be asked. And whether these, we don't know if these questions were asked, because once again, transparency is not something that has been very forthcoming in regards to the lockdown regulations. Now, I understand that ministers have said, oh, this is classified and that is classified. But once people start filing PIA applications, then things are going to start getting messy. And if you don't know what PIA is, it's the Promotion of Access to Information Act. Basically, anybody in the country can request information about how governments made certain decisions. You and I, like solitary civilians, can request this information. It does take time for these requests to be heard, but it's something that can be done. And I feel that pushing people to that point is going too far. To ask civilians to file a PIA application is just, it's ludicrous. It's too ludicrous. We are a democratic society in a democratic government that is elected by the people. All we're asking for is some transparency, guys. And I don't think that's too much to ask. All we want to know is, what were the facts that were given to us? I don't think that that's dangerous information to put in the hands of civilians. Or am I wrong here, guys?
No, we should be told that, but I doubt it will ever happen.
Yeah, it's all about power, in my opinion.
Yeah.
limiting exactly what we have access to.
This is only half a joke. This is only half a joke, but they all the official government buildings where official policies are made or whatever
should
basically be like Big Brother houses where they have cameras and you can tune in at any time. Again, half a joke. On the one hand, that's ridiculous. On the other hand, that would help a lot with transparency, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
We have cameras at Parliament, and that's a
there's a whole channel dedicated to Parliament, and I bet you its viewership numbers are very, very low.
No, we need cameras in every office. You're filling out a flipping form to get 20 Rand back on a lunch you spent on a government thing. We want to see that form being filled out.
Yeah, and I think that what needs to happen is, especially as we start lifting levels, is that planning needs to happen in a much more long-term, from a viewpoint that is much more long-term. For instance, these regulations that Minister Patel gazetted yesterday, right at the end, Section 8 reads, "These directions come into effect on the date of publication in the Government Gazette and shall remain in force for the duration of Alert Level 4. So, cool. So this is for Alert Level 4. What happens at Level 3, Level 2, Level 1? If we go back to Level 5 then, how does this change? Like, it's all good and well to have these things in place, but I think people are also looking for long-term guidance. Like, we want to know what's going to happen when we hit to level 4. Businesses want to know what happens when they hit level 3. Like, these are things that I don't think are unfair of us to ask of our leaders. And as it's like President Ramaphosa said, is like, the government hasn't been forthcoming in regards to that. They've asked us to do things, and all we've asked is for them to say, "Hey, can you tell us why?" And we get told, "Sorry, that's classified." But it ain't, mate. You're broadcasting, you're publishing your Zoom password and meeting ID on Twitter twice. It happened again this week with the Department of Water and Sanitation. You're doing that and then telling us no, but the reason that we've banned cigarette sales is classified. Come on. Pull the other one, guys. All we're asking for is government to be a bit more forthcoming about how these decisions are made. Robin?
We're asking a lot of us as citizens to adhere to regulations, and if we are doing so, we need to be, for lack of a better term, a social contract.
Yeah.
If we are going to adhere to these, the least government can do is be transparent in their decision making.
All I'm asking, Mr. Ramaphosa, if you are for some reason listening to our podcast, thanks, first of all. But I want you to hold the statement that you made on Wednesday night true. And there were a whole bunch of things that were said. But what I'm asking for is to hold up the fact that you said, "We are determined and committed to be transparent, to take the nation into confidence, and to do so regularly. Trust us with this information. Trust us that we are not going to freak out and say, hey, but this is wrong and this is wrong." If you can show us that, hey, we ban cigarettes because when people zoll, they put the saliva on the paper and, yeah. So trust us that when you give us that information, we're going to understand it. We're all adults, all right? And information is power in this regard. Knowledge is power, and the more information we have, we hear it time and time again from business, the more data you have, the better decisions you can make. And if you present that data to South Africans, they'll be able to say, "Oh, that makes sense." For instance, with the alcohol ban, it was confusing as to why, but then we got an explanation, a actual explanation for why. Listen, when people drink, there's greater strain on emergency rooms and alcohol-related incidents, and people get Dutch courage and they forget about social distancing. That makes sense, and people could accept that. Have you heard people moaning about the alcohol thing? Yes, obviously, because they want their booze back. But the reasons for it haven't been challenged because they make sense, because there's a justified reason for why this is in place. And all we're asking for is the same thing be applied to every other decision that is made in this country. Sure, there will be ones that need to be remain classified, particularly as regards to contact tracing and who has COVID-19 and all that sort of stuff. granted, that we don't, I don't need to know that. I don't, until it affects me directly, when I've come into contact with somebody who has COVID-19, I don't need to know that my neighbor has it. I don't. But when it comes to decisions that affect the whole country and affect industry and livelihoods of people, those decisions need to be transparent. Does anybody have anything else they want to add before we wrap up for today?
I still don't believe the reason why they won't let people have cigarettes is because they're going to share cigarettes. I still don't.
There's a whole song about it now, Clinton, so it must be true.
Okay, yeah. I mean, if you put it in song, you know, that's why they had bard in the old times, right?
Exactly.
Maybe you wanted to decree something. You just had the guy with the lute down at the at the tavern sing it, and then it was law. But yeah, I agree with what you said. And again, we just have to take this all with the context that government doesn't really know what it's doing because it's never done this before.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
You have to give them a little bit of slack because of that. Just like an iota. Not a lot, but a tiny bit.
And yourself, Robin, anything you want to add?
Yeah. I'm not going to be surprised when I hear that physical retailers will be able to sell anything again next week.
Yeah.
So.
And I think that's going to wrap us up this week. Thanks so much to everybody, to Clinton and Robin. We'd like to hear what you guys have to say about this. Let us know on Twitter and Facebook what your opinion is of this, whether you think it's good, whether you think it's bad, whether you want government to just be a bit more transparent about how things are done. Let us know. We'd really, really appreciate your feedback. But yeah, from us, that's going to do it for this edition of the AfriCast. From myself, Brendan Lott, cheerio. From Clinton Matos.
Hi, everybody.
And from Robin Lee Chetty.
Yeah, stay safe out there, guys.
We'll see you next week. Cheerio.
What?
Sorry, the number you have dialed is not in service at this time.